Now I'd like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Michelle A. from San Diego.
I'll lift it up. Hi, I'm Michelle. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank you for asking me to come to share tonight, and I so enjoyed your pitch. Thank you so much. And Travis, are you still here? Yeah, happy birthday, buddy. I can't see, but I know you're out there. There you are. Happy birthday, and God bless your mother. And to Catherine and Rick, happy birthday. I'm just going to share with you tonight what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on what it was like because I really want to tell you about what it's like now. And, you know, I was born in Modesto, California, home of American Graffiti and Gallo Wine. Didn't really love either one, but and didn't spend a whole lot of time there. But we moved to California soon after I was just a couple years old. And my mom, as it turns out, had been married when I was living in Modesto, California, to a man who later found out was actually an alcoholic. And he left one Christmas Eve for a pack of cigarettes and pretty much didn't come back. And she got married soon after that. I think I was just about a year and a half or 2 years old, to a man who I know as my father today, the guy that I call Dad. And, you know, that relationship lasted for about 12 years. And for me, you know, I had so many of the same feelings that you had of just not feeling good enough, not really knowing who I belong to, because I think we intuitively know things. You know, even when they're not spoken, we know when things are different for us. So my mother had a son who, you know, I had a brother, and it just always seemed a little different between John and I and my dad, although my dad and I got along really well. And when I was 12, they got divorced, and my dad moved back to New York, and that was devastating for me because I had to, you know, I was there with my mom and my brother, and she and I weren't getting along too well. And, you know, I know now today that it was really hard for her. She was a single mom, and everything she knew changed again, and she was left to find a job and, you know, provide for my brother and I. So she did that to the best of her ability. And I was in high school, I think, when I first started to drink. And I was just one of those, sort of go-getters. I mean, not scholastically a go-getter, but I always wanted to get somewhere. That's just that, gotta go. So I got a job at Kentucky Fried Chicken the day I turned 16. And I, you know, you could do that thing in high school. You could leave at noon, which I thought was great. And I could go to work and get some money. And that was great. And about that time, I met some friends that introduced me to alcohol. And, you know, it was everything I've been waiting for. That tall, skinny, I'm tall now and it works for me, but I lied on my driver's license when I was 16 because I really only weighed 99 pounds. So I wrote 110 because I was 5'9". So it was, life was really hard when you're tall and skinny with braces. And all the boys are really short. Not today, you know, there's a lot of tall girls, but then anyway. So the alcohol really helped me a lot. And, you know, one thing led to another, as it does with drugs and alcohol when you're an alcoholic, because I have that allergy of the body. And when it gets coupled with the obsession of the mind, there's a problem. So from there, you know, I was introduced to cocaine, and then I got into the restaurant business, which was really a good fit for me. And I just thought life was really, you know, it was swell. I was doing what I wanted to do. I made it through high school. My mother then remarried one more time. And this was to, let me back up. So I was 16, and I needed my driver's license. You know, I needed my birth certificate to go down to the DMV, and she says, well, you can just use your baptismal certificate. I'm like, Mom, nobody uses their baptismal certificate at the DMV. What are you talking about? You know, so she went off to work, and I went up and climbed into the closet and pulled down the shoebox of, you know, certificates. And there was my birth certificate with Michelle Ann Butler, and I'd been living Michelle Ann Davis all of my life. You know, and in that moment, it was just one more validation of who am I? Who am I? And, you know, when I talked to her about it, she just said that, you know, she thought she was going to do the happily ever after thing when she got remarried. And she didn't think there was a need for them to tell me, you know, that I had a different last name. He never adopted me. But back then, I guess you could, I had a Social Security card number with this new last name. I mean, you didn't have to have, I guess, a lot of documentation. So, and she said, you know what, if I thought he could have brought any love into your life, I would have made sure he was a part of it. But he wasn't that kind of a guy. Sort of comforting, not really, you know. So anyway, so with that, it just added to that that feeling of insecurity and who do I really belong to. So she remarried. My dad moved to New York, and my now stepfather, who I had known all my life because he and my dad were salesmen on the road together, because that was convenient, his wife had died, and so they got together and they got married. And it actually was a beautiful thing because I felt comfortable with it, because I don't know if any of you are from broken homes, but when your parents start to date, it's just ick. It was not a comfortable thing for me. So this I was comfortable with, this man I'd known, you know, for the better part of my life. And he's a great guy. They've been married for 32 years. So praise God. But anyway, so now I'm like 16, and I'm going to, you know, I finally graduate from high school. And like I said, I'm not a real big academic, so I didn't have a lot of choices as far as colleges went. So I decided to go to the local community college. And, you know, for me, it was like high school where you could smoke. And it wasn't a lot of fun. So I decided that I'd just rather work in the restaurant business. It made a whole lot more sense. You know, I was making money. I was doing what I wanted to do, and it was really a lot of fun. So I was living on the west side of town in Westwood, California, and right near UCLA, and I was having a blast. I got my own apartment. But, you know, what happened was my drinking started to accelerate. So before I was even 21, I was tending bar at this place in Century City called the Down Under Saloon, and I think the only requirement for the job was you had to wear short shorts and this little jacket with bullets in it and a hat that went up on one side. And, you know, I spent a couple of years there, and it was the perfect setup. You could drink during the day. They closed at 2, so you could sleep if you needed to. And then you could come back and cocktail at 5 till 8, make some money, and go play in Century City till the bars closed at 2, not have to be back until lunch. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that if you're an alcoholic. So, anyway, you know, this just went on, and what happens is my story is really not a whole lot different. You know, the people and the places are a little different, I think, than each of you experienced, but what happened was I was just trying to fill that hole in my soul with drugs and alcohol. I was trying to be okay, and it wasn't happening. And, you know, eventually I found myself in some pretty scary situations with a lot of lower companions. And, you know, it was scaring me. It was scaring me, but I, you know, I was one of those that never got arrested. Praise God, he didn't hurt anybody when I was out there driving in blackouts. So eventually, in my late 20s, this dad that left sent me an Easter card in the mail one year. I was 25 years old. He said, "Happy Easter, dear daughter," with this handwriting I didn't recognize. And that just, like, threw me for a loop. That was sort of the icing on my cake for the next couple of years after that. It was really hard for me to just sort of recover. I just, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. I needed some help, you know, and my mother wasn't really equipped to help me. So finally, she said, "You know what, you got to go see this gal, this psychologist lady." And I'm like, no, I'm fine, really, I'm fine, you know. And she said, no, you have to go, honey, I can't help you, I can't be objective, you got to go see this woman. So I went to see this woman, and all my friends said, "Well, whatever you do, just don't tell her that you drink." And I'm like, okay, that seemed like a really good idea to me, you know. So I spent like 6 months talking to this woman, and I tell her I take long, hot bubble baths to relax, and you know, and I'm drinking, you know, before I go there sometimes, I'm, you know, this is an AA meeting, but I'm snorting coke because it doesn't smell and, you know, whatever. So, anyway, finally I fess up that, I have a problem, not necessarily with alcohol, but I could say that I have this other problem. So she says, great, well, you know what, you need to go to a meeting of AA. I'm like, okay, well, the only reason that I went to this meeting was because there was this really cute bartender, sorry, honey, Michael T., and he'd gotten sober recently. And I thought, perfect, I'll just call Michael. You know, it seemed like that I was willing to do. So I called Michael, and he was really surprised to hear from me. And he said I could meet him at this meeting Friday night in Brentwood. I'm like, Friday night. Don't they have like a Monday morning meeting or something? I thought, that is really odd. An AA meeting on Friday night. Whatever. So I went to this meeting, and, you know, honestly, I thought I was going out on a date with Michael. I did. And I showed up at the meeting, and, you know, I walked in like any newcomer. You're freaked out, man. It's weird. All these people are talking and laughing. And so I just went up and stared at the literature for a minute. I didn't really know what else to do. And he found me, and he introduced me to this gal, and he said, there you go. I'm like, what? You know, he sent me off with the women. I'm like, what happened to our date? I thought we were... So, anyway. Oh, well. So, as I go to get into my seat, I step over this guy, and he says to me, Michelle Davis? I said, Danny? He said, yeah, this was like a high school boyfriend here at this AA meeting. It was so weird. So I sit down, and the meeting was really entertaining, I will say that. The speaker really got my attention. Her name was Yvonne, and she was talking about how her boyfriend used to spell her name in Quaaludes. And she, her name is long, like Michelle, you know, Yvonne. That's like 8 letters of Quaaludes. And I was like, wow. I was in, you know. So, anyway, that's all I remember from that meeting. Except for at the break, Danny came up to me and he said, so, you know, how long are you sober? And I go, I'm not. And he said, oh, cool, keep coming back. You know, and when I left that meeting that night, he handed me this big book. And, you know, it took me not too long. It took me about a month after that first meeting. I would go to meetings, and I report back to the psychologist, and I would drink, you know, after the meetings. And one night in December, it was about 2 weeks before Christmas, and I was now going to this Friday night meeting, and I actually shared. It was like a speaker meeting like this, only you could share for a couple of minutes at the podium. So I got up, and I shared about some nonsense where, you know, I don't have a sponsor, but I've got something else. Who knows? It was just ridiculous. And anyway, and then after the meeting, I was meeting my girlfriend at my house, and we were going out, you know. So I put on my leather skirt, and she had all the vodka and everything lined up, and off we went into the night. So we did the usual thing, and, you know, I talked about that revved-up feeling, or I was always certain that there was something better going on someplace else. One of those kind of drinkers. So, and I love dive bars. You can be a princess in a dive bar. And so we go to those dark dive bars and listen to the jukebox and just be all that, you know. And so after about 3 of these, you know, have the drink, sit down. I'm sure something else is going. Go to the next place. Go to the next place. Decide. You know what? Why don't we just go to the store and get some liquor and go home and put on our sweats and, you know, really settle in. So that seemed like a great idea. So now it's like midnight, this same Friday night that I've been at the podium. And we walk into the local Lucky Market, and I come face to face with guess who? Danny. He's like, boy, you are jonesing. I'm like, yeah. He says, well, I get off at 5 a.m. I'll see you then. I'm like, okay, yeah, sure. So I go back to my apartment with my girlfriend. I go, I better start drinking hot tea, and I'll just snort coke, and I'll be okay. So It seemed like a good plan to me, you know. So there I am, and I think I called him like once or twice. Hey, he goes, look, I told you I'd be there at 5. I'm going to come over at 5 o'clock. I said, okay. How weird is this, right? The guy comes over to my house at 5 o'clock in the morning with his big book. I still have my party dress on. And we sit down at my kitchen table, and he starts to tell me about the wonders of the program. And I'm not too interested, you know. And I said to him, by this time I couldn't help myself. I said, you don't mind, do you? You know, and I pull out my snow seal. And I start to tell him if he just only would smoke pot, he could have a really good relationship, you know. Finally, and then I decided that I was just going to crawl onto his lap and have him kiss me. So I crawl on his lap in my party dress, and he says, I'm not kissing you. You've been drinking. And I was like, nobody had ever said that to me before. And I just sort of went back to my chair with my tail between my legs, and I thought, wow, that really, you know, I mean, it's the craziest thing that God uses to speak to us, but that was the thing that spoke to me. And he got up, and he went downstairs, and I could see him trying to start his motorcycle. It wasn't starting, and I'm thinking, he's coming now, you know. He sped off into the night, and I sat there in my party dress on the floor of my apartment, and that, you know, that was my moment of clarity. It was in that moment I thought, what am I doing? What am I doing? So the next morning, I knew where these meetings were, right, because I had been going. And first I went to a friend's house and smoked some pot. And then I went to the Sunday night meeting, and I sat down, and I'm spilling my coffee, and I'm hanging out. And as I'm coming back up the stairs the next night, here's Danny Weber. And he says, are you counting days yet? And I said, I guess I am. And that was the 11th of December, 1988. So, you know, by the grace of God, I've not had to have a drug or take a drink in 21 years. That's a mighty long time. So, you know, what I really want to talk about tonight is a transformation process that happened for me once I was able to get the help I needed through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, through that fellowship of one hand reaching out to another, just through those that heart connection that just goes beyond everything. It doesn't matter what you've done, where you've been, where you live, who you are. You know what, in this room we're just all together. And I was able to find some people that I felt connected to, and I got a commitment. You know, back then they had lots of things to do, like mop the floor. They let you smoke, so you'd clean ashtrays. I mean, there was some serious stuff going on there. And so I got commitments, and I got a sponsor. And I started to stay sober one day at a time. And you know what? I hadn't done anything sober in a really long time. I mean, I the daytime freaked me out. And I remember, you know, I used to see this bumper sticker that said one day at a time, and I thought it was that TV show, you know? I was so unacquainted with sobriety. You know, I just didn't know how to do things in the daytime. And then, you know, I got sober in December, which is, it's great now because it's Christmas time and the lights are out and it's really happy. But then, 2 weeks into it, it was not a lot of fun. You know, I was 29 years old. And I had big plans for my 30th birthday. I mean, don't we all at 29? And it was Christmas. It was New Year's Eve, and in Santa Monica, they used to have this huge New Year's Eve party at the Santa Monica Civic Center. I mean, thousands and thousands of people. And I went there with Danny, and these people are like us, and they're just having a blast. You know, they're just laughing and doing those things, those obnoxious things, and they're drinking Coca-Cola, and I'm gonna lose my mind. What is wrong with these people? They are just, they're sick. What is wrong with them? It was making me so mad. I was so mad at them. What is wrong with them? And you know, Shea J's, my favorite dive bar, was right across the street. And I had my nose pressed up against the glass. You know, I could just walk over there and get a vodka and a bucket on the rocks with the water back, and it would be so much better. And Danny saw me standing with my nose pressed against the glass, and he opened the door. He said, go ahead. And, you know, and that was enough for me to just say, you know what, I'm going to make a choice. I'm going to make a choice to stay. And so I stayed. And the journey for me has been one of discovery, of finding out what I'm really made of, who I really am, more importantly, who I really want to be, because it's a journey. And I'm so, so grateful to be sober and clear-minded today. I can't tell you. In this Friday night meeting, which then became my home group, I sat in the same room with this guy right here for 2 years running. It's my husband, Bill. And, you know, we're in the same room for 2 years, and one night I got up sober and talked about a new job I had, and he got up sober and talked about some new job he had, and so we made this connection, and I found myself just sort of leaning against him, standing on a chair after the meeting for some unknown reason, and we went out to eat as we did often then, and I just sort of sat down next to him and started eating his mashed potatoes, and you know, that's sort of how it happened for us. And I had, I needed a date to a wedding was really what was going on. And it was my old boyfriend's wedding, Jeffrey, you know. And Jeffrey was just a friend, but he had had some experience some time ago with some girl that invited him to an old boyfriend's wedding. And so he had 101 questions for me. I'm like, dude, you're tall, and I just need a date for the wedding, you know. So anyway, we ended up going out on this date, and we had such an incredible time that evening. And you know what? He not only was he sober, we were both about two years sober at that time, but he was available. You know, he was an emotionally available guy, and I had never experienced anybody like that in my life. And so we're at this wedding, and God bless you for putting up with that, because it was all my high school friends. You know, ick, how uncomfortable is that? And he just was, you know, engaging and talked to everybody. And I remember Jeffrey's was up there, and Jeffrey, we made a pact, if we were both 30 and not married, we'd marry one another. It was that kind of a thing, you know. And so his mother, I always thought maybe one day would be my mother-in-law, and she pulls her new daughter-in-law aside, and Bill just comes up and puts his hand under my elbow and draws me close, you know. And I just thought, wow, that really spoke to me. And 6 months later, we were engaged. We've been married 18 years this July. We have three beautiful children in the program of, we were sober when we had the kids, so they're not in the program. It's that mom stuff. It's that mom stuff. I was sitting here tonight really with a heavy heart, a very joyful heart, but a very heavy heart for that mother's deep, deep love for her child and that powerlessness when we have to release them to the journey that they're on, you know? It takes such courage to do that. So, and to hear the son say, you know, that they can actually now, on the other side of it, acknowledge where they were and what they've done. And that to me, there's no greater gift. So what I want to talk about in the last bit of time that I have here is my program of recovery. Because, you know, I am sort of a gal who likes to do the work, surprisingly enough. You know, I didn't think I was that kind of a gal, but once you put the 12 steps in front of me, I was ready to do the work. So I did the work when I first got sober, and I did my inventory, and I sponsored people, and I had commitments, and like I said, I got married, and we had these three beautiful, exhausting children, and and it was all good. You know, it was all good. And about, James was born in 1997. So about that time, just before he was born, we'd been living up in LA, and we had roots in that community. You know, Billy and I both got sober there. So we left that home group, that hometown of ours, and we moved to San Diego. And that's the one thing about AA is, you know, it's everywhere. It's all across the globe. You can find a meeting of AA, and Billy travels a lot and did then. And so I just, you know, I found a meeting, and I found some girls, and I needed a boy because I had three kids under four. You know, that's like insane. And so anyway, I hooked into the program here, and all was going pretty well. As well as, I mean, it's kind of go good if you just stay sober and you do the work, or even if you're sort of half-heartedly doing the work, you're not picking up a drink, you're okay. But there came to me a point for me in my sobriety where I really wanted to know who I was turning my will and my life over to. I was just a little over 10 years sober, 40 years old, and I have some questions. And so I went on this journey to find out who it was I was turning my will and my life over to. And it was a ride, let me tell you. And you know what? For me, I wanted a big God. I wanted a God that whatever was over my head was under his feet. I needed to know that with assurance that whatever I was going to go through, that he was going to be there holding me in his right hand. I just needed to know that with everything I had. So I went on this journey. And, you know, it was exhilarating, and it was scary, and it was hard, because I was on a journey, man, and there was nobody, you know, nobody could stop me. And so it's hard for people to understand a lot of times, I think, when you're, you know, you've got a personal journey going on, because you have to be willing to stand alone. You know, I had met my maker, so to speak, and I was determined to live for an audience of one. And when you do that, it can be really lonely. It can be really lonely. But you know what? What comes after that? There's nothing like it. There is just nothing like it. So I went on this journey, and life changed for me dramatically. Everything sort of opened up like an IMAX theater. You know, things got brighter. I didn't have the deep highs and the lows. Things changed for me. And what I want to say about that is that journey that I was on has carried me through some really hard times. You know, there's a gal who's a hero of mine, and her name is Corrie ten Boom. And she was a Dutch woman whose father was a watchmaker, and they housed Nazis during that time. And a couple of things that she said about her life was that she was going through a really hard time, and she asked her dad about it, and he said, "Corrie, when we get ready to take that train to Amsterdam, when do I give you the ticket?" She says, "When I'm ready to board the train." He goes, "It's the same way with God, Corrie. You know, he's there right on time." And that's been my experience. He's seldom early. He's never late. But he is always on time. You know, and sometimes, man, you're waiting at that station. When is that train coming? Because I need my ticket. So, anyway, I started this journey, and what I want to say about that is I've had some mile markers, you know, in my sobriety. That one when I was 10 years sober, and I went on this quest to find who I was turning my will and my life over to. And another one more recently. And that was this past summer. I had been, I had not really been working a program of Alcoholics Anonymous rigorously in a while. And that was because I had this sweet relationship going on with my God. And that was sustaining me. You know, I felt like I was doing all right, but I somehow got back into the rooms of AA, and I found a meeting that really spoke to me, because it was solution-based, and we stayed on the solution, and I really dug that. And so I made a commitment to work the 12 steps over in a different kind of way that I hadn't done before, turning all the statements into questions in the book. It's a rigorous process. It took me a long time, but I did it, you know, and I did an inventory in a way that I'd never done an inventory before. And I had, at 21 years sober, 32 people on my resentment list. Because you know what? I wanted to get everybody, man. If I'm going to do it, I want to do it. And you know, I'll just back up to say that I had many dear friends that were doing the work, because I'm a worker, I really wanted to do it. I really did want to do it. But with me, if God doesn't convict me to do it, it's not worth doing. It's just not the time to do it. So when I got the kick in the gut at this meeting one night, and I said, that's it. Here's your ticket. Here you go. So I started to do this work, and when I got to this inventory, and you know, the nearest and the dearest to me, of course, were on it, and my son James was on it, and I love that voice so much with everything I have. I have two boys. James is 12 now, Jack is 14, and my daughter Madeline is 16. And Jamesy, they tell me, is going to be a leader. You know what that means? That means he's going to get into a lot of trouble, and he's got great ideas. He's got great ideas. But I did this inventory on him, and I am his touchstone. I am his touchstone. You know, and when I got to this inventory and all the things that I resented about James, man, he's a risk taker. He doesn't, you know, wants everybody else to do his work for him. And he puts himself in harm's way and all this. And I'm going through this inventory the first time, and I'm really getting into it until I got to flip the page over and look at the backside, which is the realization of how much I'm like my son James or anybody else that I'm having an issue with. You know, and so the question comes back to me, well, Michelle, you a risk taker?
Shoot.
Yeah. Okay. Did you ever put yourself in harm's way? Oh. You know. Have you ever let anybody do your work for you? Okay. And you know, through that process, I got to see him in a different light, and that I was under the delusion that my big God wasn't available to him. You know, that if I didn't do it, manage, control it, keep him out of harm's way, keep him from being a risk taker, that that big God wasn't going to show up for him. So doing this inventory this way, doing the amends this way, has just been an amazing journey for me. And I have to tell you that God, it's been my experience that where God leads, he always proceeds. He always proceeds. He's already there. He's been there. He's seen that. He's done it. He's waiting for me to go through the process. Because for me, God is just all about process, baby. He's just not really, you know, it's just that drawing closer to being God-reliant instead of self-reliant. And being self-reliant got me drunk and into really dangerous places. But if I'm God-reliant, I've got an umbrella of protection around me, and I can bank on that. So, you know, I've done the work now, started in June, and after the first of the year, something comes out of left field at me. I'm not a betting woman, because I'd rather just buy something, just give me the money, I don't want to put it on the table. You know, but I would have bet you that I wouldn't, no, this wouldn't happen to me. And you know what, it was happening to me. And what I'm here to tell you today, not that far down the road from it, this is, you know, early this year, is that I had an inexplicable peace that passed all understanding during this time. I have never felt more connected to my God. I have never felt just that unshakable substance that, you know, you put the money in the bank for. And there was no reason for me to feel this way. And it still sort of perplexes me. But I, you know what, that feeling was everything to me. Because it explains so much. Because you know what, life is really hard. There's a lot of really difficult things each one of us has to go through. And I am a real, I'm a feeler. So when Will Wardrip's mom loses her son in October, I can't breathe. I'm wondering how she's getting through everything. That's me. I'm like, oh, Lord, what is going on with this? You know what I got from this with me was? Will's mom had that peace that passed all understanding. Will's mom was able to take one step in front of the other. She was able to breathe deeply because she knew that whatever was over her head was under his feet. You know what? To me, that is what life is worth living for. You know, that is it. That is the essence of the whole thing. And I was like, whoa. So when I got out of the immediate crisis of all of it, I grieved it, if you can even understand that. I missed being in such deep need. Because you know what it is? Because it's only, I got to tell you, I hope it changes, but it's really only when I'm in such deep need that I'm willing to surrender it all. I'm willing to just say, take it. And that's the key, baby, that's the secret, is, you know, when you just say, take it, I can't, he can't, I'm going to let him, then it just all comes together. It all comes together. So I am just here to say tonight that, you know, wow, what a ride life is. And Alcoholics Anonymous has offered me the opportunity to get clean enough and clear enough, conscious enough, to know that I was just so deeply longing and wanting something that had been available to me all along. All along, you know? And I'm so grateful to have that gift in my life today. And for my children to be raised, you know, in a sober home. My daughter really wanted to come tonight. She's out of town, and I have really mixed feelings about that. She hasn't really heard my whole story, and my hero Corey, she also has another little part in her book where she's asking her dad some really hard questions about some hard subjects, and they're actually on a train to Amsterdam, and he says, you know what, Corey, you know your luggage? He says, do you put it up there on the rack yourself? And she says, no, Daddy, you do. He goes, that's because it's too heavy for you to carry right now. And, I'm getting close, but some of this stuff is just too heavy for my kids to carry right now, and I just trust God that he will let me know when the time is right, like he always does. So I'm so grateful to be here tonight, and if you're newly sober, I hope I haven't scared you too much. It's really just an incredible, incredible journey, like none other. And I just want to, I got a hold of the long version of the Serenity Prayer about 10 years ago, and I'm going to close with that tonight. It's, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as the pathway to peace, taking as he did this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, trusting that he will make everything right. I'm losing it. If I surrender to his will, that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him forever in the next. Thank you.